Good afternoon, this is Marco. You are listening to Astor Talk on CITR 101.9. This program is coming to you live on Thursday afternoon on the 22nd, but I'm doing it close to midnight on the 21st. I got home late because I was in West Vancouver and there was a serious car accident and it closed the bridge and blah, blah, blah. All these things happened and people were waiting for hours. So anyway, good afternoon. I am going to talk some astronomy. And, of course, I've been thinking a lot about the Artemis program, the launch to the moon, and then they're going to send astronauts to the moon in a few years. So this is apparently all a preparation for going to Mars. And when that happens, I'd like to see it, because I don't know if I'll be alive. It's likely that it'll take a long time to get to Mars. And we know probably one of the complications is, how do you pack four people in a little capsule, not very big, and send them on a six-month trip to Mars, and they land, and then they got to wait there for a while until they came back, because Mars and Earth move relative to each other, so they have to wait until 23 months or so when Earth and the Moon, Earth and Mars are closest together. So they'll fly 6 months to get there, 6 months to get back. So that leaves, they'll be about on the Moon for about a, on Mars for about a year. So there are a lot of complications. And what I was thinking too, how do you get a rocket up there to blast off from the surface of Mars and power them back home? So just like Elon Musk said, for our future space travel, what is required is reusable rockets. So there's lots to consider. What will astronauts eat? What will they drink? Blah, blah, blah. There's lots of things. So I don't hold out any hope, because we know Webb was delayed about 14 years. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about the Artemis launch, because that's what's NASA's biggest concern, and they're testing it again. And again, I was thinking, this is my thought, but I'm not a rocket scientist. I don't design rockets, I don't test them, I don't fly them. But we've done this before. We've gone to the moon, we've launched a lot of vehicles on their way to other parts of the solar system, and the Voyagers, we've launched them out of the solar system. So it seems so simple. There's a fuel leak or pressure leak, or can't cool the engine as much as they want to. So there's been a lot of problems with the Artemis launch so far. So we'll see how it goes. All will be forgotten if Artemis is able to blast off, and I guess September sometime will be, there will be a launch window towards the end of September, maybe October 1st. But then another, I think it's the SpaceX launch, takes precedent. So they will launch from there. So if it doesn't happen soon, it won't happen till maybe mid-October or late October. So there are going to be, not me anymore. I'm not gonna watch it, because I was let down and I get my hopes up. So Artemis 1 will be launching off one day, I hope, and then in a few years' time the astronauts will go to the moon. And I'm not sure if in the first run whether they just circle the moon and do various tests, but China has a rover on the far side of the moon, and they plan to the South Pole, a joint mission with the Russians. So there is a lot going on in terms of what's going to happen on the moon in the future. And this Artemis launch was supposed to, I believe they're called CubeSats, seven satellites that will be launched from the Orion spacecraft. I think one of the CubeSats will actually land on the moon. So we are waiting for what is going to happen when they finally launch. And to me, that'll be exciting. I believe it's a 6-week mission. And life science is not talking about Artemis anymore, but space.com is. So I'm going to go to space.com. And when I go to space.com, there's a story about NASA's Artemis 1 moon mission. So I will read this story. It's titled, NASA's Artemis 1 moon rocket passes crucial fueling test, which is good. So this was published by Mike Wall 6 hours ago. So right now I'm coming to you on the 21st. So it was published September 21st. And the subtitle is, the Artemis 1 team will now assess if the rocket will be ready for a planned September 27 liftoff. So there's the picture of the Artemis rocket. NASA's Artemis 1 moon rocket passed a crucial fueling test Wednesday on September 21st, potentially keeping it on track for a planned September 27 liftoff. Artemis 1 will send an uncrewed Orion capsule to lunar orbit using a giant space launch system, SLS rocket. NASA tried to launch the mission on September 3rd, but was thwarted by a leak of liquid hydrogen propellant at a quick disconnect on the SLS core stage, an interface linking the rocket with a fuel line from its mobile launch tower. The Artemis 1 team replaced two seals around the quick disconnect on September 9, then scheduled a fueling test to see if the fix worked. That test occurred Wednesday on launch pad 39B at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and it brought good news for the mission, which is nice. Now, I'm going to try to play a video now about the Artemis 1 launch, and I believe it's the Artemis 1 launch, but anyway, it's going to be something about Artemis. So I will play the video. It is loading now. I hope you enjoy it.
This is Artemis Launch Control. At the completion of the Artemis 1 cryogenic demonstration test, I'm Daryl Nail with NASA Communications, and with all of the test objectives met, we have Charlie Blackwell Thompson with us, the launch director for the Artemis mission. Thanks for being here, Charlie. Charlie just wrapped up comments with her launch team after a long day of testing and a challenging day at times, but overall, a lot of success. I want to get your thoughts, Charlie, on how the test went in your mind.
Well, I think the test went really well. We went into this test, we wanted to learn, we wanted to evaluate the TSMU, the LH2 TSMU under cryogenic conditions, understanding that we had done both an 8-inch and a 4-inch seal removal and replacement out at the pad. And we got into our loading operations. We had a new loading procedure that we had in place. It was very purposeful in the way in which we went through the loading ops. We wanted to be, we called it kinder, gentler, where we really monitored the temperatures and the pressures across the interface. And once we got into what we call our fast fill operations, we did notice as the pressure came up that we did see a leak in the plate cavity at the 8-inch QD. We went through our pre-plan. We have utilized it a couple of times where we stop flow and we allow it to warm up and then we reinitiate. When we reinitiated flow, we began to raise the pressures back up to get back into a fast fill configuration, and we are successful in that. So we did not see the same leak signature, which is was wonderful. It allowed us to go through our loading profile all the way to core stage replenish. We also loaded the upper stage today as well, went through our kickstart bleed, went through our pre-press test. So all of the objectives that we set out to do, we were able to accomplish today.
And it was impressive just to watch and take in and listen to the engineers as they worked through those leaks. Impressive work. I wonder what your thoughts are on these seals, which, as you mentioned, were replaced. You're learning a lot. There's a lot of data yet to look at. What are your early thoughts about how they're behaving and what a path forward might be?
Well, I think you got to always take the data and go look at what it tells you. One of the pieces of data very encouraging to me was as we raised the pressure, we actually saw the leak go down.
And, on the 8-inch cube.
Yes. Yeah. And so this is a pressure seal, pressure-assisted seal. So that was very encouraging. And then, you know, we saw the leak rate really taper off. So we'll go take all the data from this event, the early data, the data all the way through loading, through our pre-press test, the engineers and the team will go take a close look at that and evaluate what we learned today, and then we'll certainly be applying that as we get ready for launch.
Big question is, as you just mentioned, getting ready for launch. What does that mean? What are the chances for a launch here on the 27th?
Well, I think we'll take the data and we'll go see what it tells us. I am extremely encouraged by the test today, get through all the objectives, and we're setting up in our scrub turnaround to begin replenishment ops in preparation for our launch day. We'll go take a look at the data. I think I don't like to get ahead of the data. And so I'd like the team to have the opportunity to go look at it, to see if there are changes we need to make to our loading procedure, our timelines, or if we're, you know, good as is. But I'd like the team to have an opportunity to look at that before I speculate.
And last question on the team itself. You know, as we encountered that first leak, you could kind of feel the room deflate just a little bit. And then as they worked it and got past it, there was a lifting, so to speak, of the room. But talk about kind of what you went through when you were observing this and what you saw your team and how they reacted.
Well, I'm really proud of the team. I think they reacted well. You're going to be disappointed when you see a leak, and I think that's normal. But what they did is they went and looked at what are our contingency procedures, what do we have in place, how do we work our way through it, and they went through those ops just as I would expect them to do, and we were successful in managing our way through it. And you're right, as we began to see that those contingency procedures were successful, certainly there was a lift within the room. But I couldn't be more proud of the team today and the work that they did.
And so now you march on and get that data, take a look at it, and see where it leads us. Charlie Blackwell Thompson, Launch Director for Artemis, appreciate you being here. Thanks for taking the time, and that'll wrap it up for us here at NASA TV in the Kennedy Space Center. Our test coverage complete today, and stay tuned to all of our social media channels for more information and updates about where we go from here. I want to just say that with regards to the Artemis program, it is a new era of lunar exploration. NASA and its partners will lead humanity forward to the moon and prepare us for the next giant leap, the human exploration of Mars. If you'd like to learn more about Artemis 1, just go to our website, nasa.gov/Artemis-1.
Okay, so that seemed to work okay. But believe it or not, behind the scenes, I tried to play it a few times and it finally did work. But what I took away from that press conference is, wow, that person knows their stuff. And it's all very complicated. It's not so easy. And I guess I'm the one that criticizes. Yes, I do. Because I can't wait for this stuff to happen. And when it's delayed, then I get cranky. No, I don't get cranky. I just become sad. So anyway, the Charlie Blackwell Thompson, she broke down what happened, and said like a pro, wow, it's very impressive to hear a person with that knowledge on rockets and things like that. And then what I'm hoping for and what everybody's hoping for, September 27 launch. And you couldn't see this, but during the press conference there, they were doing close-up shots of the SLN's launch rocket and the top where the Orion spacecraft is, and just to see this machinery, it's very impressive. These big rockets at the bottom that are going to shoot this baby up into the sky. So you heard it from Charlie Blackwell Thompson, not from me, the expert on this all, and it's very interesting to listen. Okay, so Launch Director Charlie Blackwell Thompson with the Exploration Ground Systems Program at Kennedy Space Center said in brief remarks after Wednesday's test, which took up most of the day, and this is a quote, "All the objectives that we set out to do, we were able to accomplish today," end quote, which is nice to hear. That's not to say that everything went perfectly. For example, the leak at the quick disconnect popped up again during liquid hydrogen loading, but the team managed to troubleshoot it. They warmed up the quick disconnect, allowing it to reseat, which reduced the leak rate to acceptable levels. Artemis 1 personnel also noticed a different hydrogen leak during a pre-pressurization test, which was also part of Wednesday's activities. So again, a simple person like me that doesn't know rocket science would ask, why would they have leaks at this stage when they've shot so many rockets in the sky? So why is there a leak? So I guess this is a new system, space launch system, a new rocket. So probably tests like this will, leaks will happen and small things will happen to frustrate me. But anyway, they happen. That this test enabled engineers to calibrate the settings used for conditioning the engine during the terminal count and validate timelines before launch day to reduce schedule risk during the countdown on launch day, NASA's official explained in the blog post after the test wrapped up. So I guess if you guys want to read the blog, you can. Just go to this article. Again, it's called, the article is called NASA's Artemis 1 Moon Rocket Passes Crucial Fueling Test by Mike Wall, published September 21st. So you can go to space.com and look up this article, and it will have a link to that blog post. And then you can, if you like, you can go and look at the blog post. This second leak was smaller than the other one, and the Artemis 1 team was able to keep it under control, agency officials said. NASA is currently eyeing September 27th as the launch target for Artemis 1, with a possible backup date of October 2nd. It's too soon to make a formal commitment to either of those dates, despite Wednesday's success, Blackwell Thompson said. And quote, I think we'll take the data and we'll go see what it tells us. I am extremely encouraged by the test today and getting through all of our objectives, end quote. Some other things have to go Artemis 1's way for the mission to launch in the next 2 weeks as well. The weather has to cooperate, for instance, and that's never a certainty on Florida's Space Coast. The mission must also get a waiver on the certification of its flight termination system, FTS, which is designed to destroy the SLS if it veers off course during launch. So here, I'll try to play another video and let's see if it's successful, because sometimes I have problem playing these on my ugly computer.
Welcome back to coverage of the Artemis 1 cryogenic demonstration test timeline here at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Welcoming those who are watching on NASA's public channel back to our coverage. We are currently monitoring the cryogenic tanking of the Space Launch System rocket, which you see on your screen there. We started prop load at 7:30 a.m. this morning, flowing liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. But at 5 minutes past 10 a.m. this morning, Eastern time, we went into stop flow on the liquid hydrogen side. The air area you're looking at is the tail service mast umbilical. That is the gray protrusion that comes up at the zero deck on the mobile launch platform. And you can see the lines that go into the bottom of the rocket. Those are the fuel lines, amongst other lines, provide gaseous commodities to operate valves, as well as fluid lines for hydraulic maneuvers. This shot here, you're looking exactly at the location where just minutes ago the liquid hydrogen team detected.
Sorry for the pause, but it's their pause, so hopefully they'll start
just listening to the launch team. LHY, the liquid hydrogen team, reporting to the NASA test director that the leak has the same signature as the previous leak that caused a launch scrub on September 3rd. The percentage hydrogen that was detected was 7%, according to the hydrogen team. And so now they have just gotten signed off a plan from the launch director, a pre-plan, in the case of a leak like this, which is one that they did, you may be familiar with if you followed our launch coverage of the first launch attempt, which is a similar pattern, a plan, that was used to warm up the line that goes into the rocket and fills it with hydrogen. You're looking inside now at the firing room one, and in the center of that room is the cryogenic propulsion team, and they are the ones that are working this current plan. They're going to let the line warm up. They've allowed it to stop flow. They're going to allow it to warm up a little bit, and then in the hopes that when they start flow again, it will reseat the connection in hopes of curing the leak. We can take a look at that that area in the lower portion of the rocket where they are working that. There's an 8-inch fill line. This is the fuel line that provides the liquid hydrogen into the bottom of the rocket. It goes from the tail service mast umbilical on the left into the rocket on the right, on the left into the rocket on the right. And at that point where they connect, that is the umbilical disconnect point. Once the rocket lifts off the pad, the fuel lines must disconnect at that moment. Once the boosters light, that is when the umbilicals disconnect. And in that point where they are connected, there is a flight plate on the rocket side and a ground plate on the ground side where they disconnect. And it is in that area. We've got a shot of it. It is in that area, right there. That's the connection point. The vapor you see is liquid oxygen. It's actually not indicative of the liquid hydrogen leak. That leak is actually contained in between the plates there. The square plate, you can't see the entire square plate, but you can see part of it. Inside that plate where the lines connect into the rocket and fill the tank with liquid hydrogen, that's where they saw a 7% hydrogen leak. And so it automatically went into stop flow. The configuration is safe. And now they are allowing that line right there to warm up a bit for about a half hour. And then they're going to reinitialize the flowing of propellant back into the rocket. Again, launch director Charlie Blackwell Thompson signed off on the plan to warm up the line. We're currently in stop flow on liquid hydrogen. And they are slowing the fill on the liquid oxygen side, which is currently at around 45% filled. Again, 45% filled on the liquid oxygen side. Liquid hydrogen currently in stop flow while the team works a plan to warm up the line and try to reseat a connection point into the rocket in hopes of curing a leak that was detected at just 5 minutes past 10 a.m.
Okay, so there you have it from people that are experts, and I apologize for that. There was a lot of spaces in between, and we're told here at UBC CITR, don't have empty space on your broadcast. But this guy was listening to, well, I think he was watching what engineers were doing to repair the problem. So he had to tell us what those people were doing. Sometimes he'd listen to them talk, sometimes he'd watch them. And then there was photos, and it just shows how complicated this whole thing is. So I'll keep reading the article. The U.S. Space Force, which oversees the Eastern Range for rocket launches, certified Artemis 1's FTS for 25 days, and that time is now up. The mission has applied for a waiver. If it's not granted, the huge rocket will have to be rolled from Pad 39B back to the Kennedy Space Center's Vehicle Assembly Building, the only place where recertification can occur. So says Tom Whitmire, a NASA's Deputy Associate Administrator for Common Exploration Systems Development, during a press conference on Monday, said, and quote, "Right now, we're still in the process of having technical discussions with the range," end quote. And this is referring to the waiver situation. It's been very productive and collaborative. Artemis 1 has already received one such FTS waiver, which extended the certification from 20 to 25 days. If all goes well, Artemis 1, Artemis 2 will launch astronauts, if all goes well with Artemis 1, Artemis 2 will launch astronauts around the moon in 2024, and Artemis 3 will put boots down near the launch South Pole a year or two later. So it looks like people will not set foot on the moon until 2026 again. The Artemis program ultimately aims to establish a long-term human presence on and around the moon, and to use the skills and knowledge gained in doing so to get astronauts to Mars in the late 2030s or early 2040s. Okay, so that's an update on the Artemis one. And when I looked at it, yes, it is very complicated. And I don't have to say that. It's easy to understand that. So what I'll do now, I will go for a break. And when we return, we'll talk more astronomy on CITR 101.9.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world. And guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansem, Hydra CM, Nisiyam
Nisiyaya, and the Sakuya Talitin, Homasque Mustail. Okay, welcome back. I'm just going to read a bit about Artemis. There's a few links there. And this one is called this NASA's Artemis 1 program. Facts about NASA's Artemis program, which aims to send astronauts back to the moon and one step closer to Mars. NASA's Artemis program is an effort to place astronauts on the lunar surface and develop an ongoing presence there. Artemis 1 is due to launch at the end of August, with the first launch window scheduled for August 29th. Backup launch windows are set for September 2nd and 5th. To stay up to date with the missions, check out our Artemis 1 Moon Mission Update page. The program's name is derived from Artemis, the Greek goddess of the moon and twin sister to Apollo, whose namesake program first brought astronauts to our natural satellite on July 20, 1969. The Artemis program is a renaming of several earlier activities NASA was already undertaking to return humans to the moon. These were mandated by President Trump's Space Policy Directive 1, which tasked the agency with focusing on missions to the moon. In 2019, Vice President Mike Pence set an ambitious deadline to land humans at the lunar South Pole by 2024. Perhaps the most ambitious of the Artemis mission's objectives involves using the moon as a stepping stone for a mission to Mars. Robots have done all the detective work on Mars so far, but NASA now aims to send astronauts there by the 2030s. So let's reemphasize, they're saying the late 2030s, so let's say 2040, which is 18 years away. With a future target set on the Red Planet, the return to the moon will be used to provide us with the knowledge and tools to better navigate our solar system. But how can the moon help prepare us for a mission to Mars, an entirely different and more unpredictable mission? Three times, NASA astronaut Stephen Swanson, who has logged over 195 days in space at the International Space Station, spoke about the significance of Artemis with Space.com's sister publication, How It Works, and which is a magazine. So here is this person speaking, Stephen Swanson, end quote. The real goal is Mars, and we'll use the moon as a testbed because Mars is a very difficult mission. It's a 7 or 8 month journey to get there, and you have to wait 15 months there for the planets to align correctly again before you return. As well as Mars, we can also use the moon as a testbed for other things to see how we can actually gather materials from the moon itself and maybe use that to make our fuel. End quote. On May 14, 2019, the mission's goals were given the new moniker Artemis. Joe Berdenstein, the space agency's administrator, told reporters on the day of the announcement that the name represents the program's goal of inclusion, referring to the fact that NASA intends to land the first woman on the moon under its current plans. And so says Berdenstein, in quote, I have a daughter who is 11 years old, and I want her to be able to see herself in the same role as the next woman or woman or women who go to the moon see themselves in today, end quote. So here's a couple of women here. There's a photo of them, NASA astronauts Jessica Marr and Christine Koch on the International Space Station. So their hair is blowing. I don't know why. Is that their hair blowing or do they have something on it? But anyway, these are two ladies on the International Space Station. Between 1969 and 1972, six missions took place in which 12 people walked on the surface of the moon, all of them men. For such a high-risk mission, the most experienced astronauts were required, and at the time there were no women at NASA who had the suitable test flight experience. For a long time, space was viewed as an industry primary for men, and it wasn't until 1978 that NASA selected its first female astronaut. As of March 2022, 75 women have been to space, and the Artemis 1 moon launching will serve as a reminder of changing times. While it's currently undecided who will be chosen, it will likely be one of NASA's astronauts who has already worked aboard the International Space Station. In December 2020, NASA announced the Artemis team of astronauts, which included 9 women: Kayla Bannon, Christina H. Koch, Nicole A. Mann, Anne McLean, Jessica Meyer, Jasmine Mogbelli, Kate Rubens, Jessica Watkins, and Stephanie Wilson, and 9 men were also chosen. In August 2022, Chief Astronauts Reid Wiseman announced that all active astronauts are eligible for Artemis missions with crew selections to be determined at a later date. So there's three-part plan. Artemis 1 is the first mission will be uncrewed to test the safety of the SLS rocket and the Orion capsule's ability to reach the moon, perform in lunar orbit, and return to Earth for an ocean splashdown. The SLS rocket will carry 13 small satellites into space to perform experiments and technology demonstrations. For 6 days, the craft will orbit the moon, collecting performance data. The mission will launch on August 29th, and that's since been changed, and return to Earth on October 10th to end a 42-day mission. So obviously those dates have changed. Now, in 2024, Artemis 2 carrying the first four Artemis astronauts, the Orion capsule will take the crew farther from Earth than humans have ever traveled before. Over the approximately 10-day mission, the crew will complete a lunar flyby and return to Earth, evaluating the spacecraft systems while carrying humans. And then Artemis 3, which they say is 2025, this will see the next man and first woman step onto the lunar surface. Providing previous missions have been successful, the astronauts will shoot towards the moon, using the lunar lander to lower two people to the moon's southern pole region. They will remain on the moon for around a week. So here there's a nice diagram that shows this. And what the Artemis program includes. Artemis 1's umbrellas are several components. First is a lunar orbiter platform gateway, a station around the moon that would extend humanity's presence in space and provide a platform for scientific experiments and jaunts to the lunar surface. Now this is exciting. For me it is anyway. The gateway would be carried into lunar orbit by the agency's SLS rocket, a gigantic new rocket NASA is developing. Four-person crews would access the station using the Orion Deep Space Capsule and remain for 30 to 90 day stints. Exciting, isn't it? Part of the Trump administration's push towards the moon includes an enlarged role for private aerospace firms, which are intended to develop hardware and potentially kickstart a lunar economy. NASA has awarded $45.5 million to 11 U.S. companies, including Elon Musk, SpaceX, and Jeff Bezos, Blue Origin, to develop landers that can take astronauts to the moon's surface. SpaceX was selected to provide the Artemis 3 crewed lander based on that company's huge Starship vehicle. Nine smaller businesses have also been contacted to deliver robotic spacecraft to our natural satellite in order to collect data and conduct research there. Some have taken an interest in mining lunar resources, such as water, which can be split into its constituent hydrogen and oxygen and converted into rocket fuel. So this reminds me, the other day I was with a student, and maybe 15 years old, and he asked me, do you want to book your next flight into space? And I said, really? And he showed me the page. And apparently 2022 and 2023 are all sold out. And he chose an arbitrary date and try to book a flight, and it would cost $1.2 million. So that's maybe in our future too. A lot of people will be going, well, people that can afford it, the price will probably go down, but people might be going, it might be a tourist destination, space, which is exciting. NASA has unveiled Artemis generation spacesuits designed especially for a mission. One for the launch and landing worn inside the spacecraft, and one to protect the bodies of those venturing outside the protection of the Orion capsule. The suits will be custom fit to their bodies with the aim of improving upon the comfort and practicality of previous versions. Now here's something called Tech Check. The launch rocket is responsible for the all-important task of firing the capsule and crew into space. The Space Launch System is NASA's new rocket, designed for human space travel beyond Earth's orbit, having to travel almost 1,000 times farther than those headed for the International Space Station. It's designed to reach speeds of 25,000 miles per hour or 40,000 kilometers per hour. Approximately 8 minutes after the launch, the core stage falls away and the astronauts continue with their journey to the moon. So. Now, here's a question. Where is Artemis going? For the initial Artemis moon missions, the selected astronauts will fly to the moon's south pole. This area has great potential and is believed to be home to the highest abundance of water ice. If we can extract this water, it could be used to sustain human exploration farther into space, whether that's as a human hydration source, rocket fuel resource, or cooling system for equipment. So I am going to go for another break now, and when we come back, who knows, will I be talking about Artemis again? We'll see. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CATR 101.9.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost. I'm just living my dream. Check us out online at ubc-voc.com. For everybody who should live it, live it, live it. Go
and get it, you should live it, live it, live it. Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. Now, I guess it's pretty clear I'm going to devote this whole show to Artemis. One of the links in the previous article was Moon, South Pole, and NASA's landing site. So this article was done April 15th, 2019. So I'm going to read this article. NASA is working right now to send American astronauts to the surface of the Moon in 5 years, and the agency has its sights set on a place no humans have ever gone before, the lunar South Pole. Water is a critical resource for long-term exploration, and that's one of the main reasons NASA will send astronauts to the Moon's South Pole by 2024. Water is a necessity for furthering human exploration because it could potentially be used for drinking, cooling equipment, breathing, and make it rocket fuel for missions farther into the solar system. The experience NASA gains on the Moon, including using lunar natural resources, will be used to help prepare the agency to send astronauts to Mars. So I'm wondering if one day, not too far in the future, there will be missions to Mars for tourists. Go to Mars, just like Arnold Schwarzenegger did in, I forget what that movie is called, let me think, it'll come to me. So says Stephen Clark, Deputy Association, Associate Administrator of the Science Mission Directorate at NASA's headquarters in Washington, end quote, "We know the South Pole region contains ice and may be rich in other resources based on our observations from orbit. But otherwise, it's a completely unexplored world. The South Pole is far from the Apollo landing sites, clustered around the equator, so it will offer us a new challenge and a new environment to explore as we build our capabilities to travel farther into space," end quote. The South Pole is also a good target for a future human landing because robotically it's the most thoroughly investigated region on the Moon. The elliptical polar orbit of NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, LRO, is closest to the Moon during its pass over the South Pole region. Though its thousands of orbits in the last decade, or through its thousands of orbits in the last decade, LRO has collected the most precise information about the South Pole region than any other, offering scientists precise details about its topography, temperature, and locations of likely frozen water. NASA has mapped every square meter, even areas of permanent shadow, of the lunar South Pole. There's still so much to learn about Earth's nearest neighbor. Ahead of a human return, NASA is planning to send new science instruments and technology demonstration payloads to the Moon using commercial landers through Commercial Lunar Payload Services, CLPS. These robotic precursors will further investigate regions of interest to human explorers, including the South Pole, and will provide information to the engineers designing modern lunar surface systems. Now here's a subsection titled Water on the Moon. The floors of polar craters reach frigid temperatures because they're permanently in shadow as a result of the low angle at which sunlight strikes the Moon's surface in the polar regions, and also because the Moon has no atmosphere to help warm up its surface. This angle is based on the 1.54 degree tilt of the Moon's axis. Earth's tilt is 23.5 degrees. If an astronaut was standing near the South Pole, the sun would always appear on the horizon, illuminating the surface sideways, and thus skimming primarily the rims of deep craters and leaving their deep interiors in shadow. These permanently shadowed craters feature some of the lowest temperatures in the solar system, down to minus 414 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 248 degrees Celsius. Water ice is stable at those temperatures, and it's believed that some of these craters harbor significant ice deposits. The South Pole's frozen water may date back billions of years and has been untainted by the sun's radiation or the geological processes that otherwise constantly churn and renew planetary surface. Think of wind and erosion on Earth, offering us a window into the early solar system. So says John W. Keller, a lunar scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And quote, that record of water collection is a record that can help us understand how water and other volatiles have been moving around the solar system. So we're very interested in getting to these locations and sampling the material there. End quote. Studying surface samples of ice from polar regions on Earth, for example, has revealed how our planet's climate and atmosphere have evolved over thousands of years. Now here's another subsection called Constant Light and Power. Other extremes at the Moon's South Pole are not so dark and cold. There are also areas near Shackleton Crater, for instance, that are bathed in sunlight for extended periods of time, over 200 Earth days of constant illumination. This happens also because of the Moon's tilt and is a phenomena that we experience at our own polar regions on Earth. Unrelenting sunlight is a boon to Moon missions, allowing explorers to harvest sunlight in order to light up a lunar base and power its equipment. I just remembered that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. It's called Total Recall. The President's direction from Space Policy Directive 1 galvanizes NASA's return to the Moon and builds on progress on the Space Launch System rocket and Orion spacecraft. Collaborations with U.S. industry and international partners and knowledge gained from current robotic assets at the Moon and Mars. So I was showing somebody the other day the mashed potato. That's when the Boston Dynamics robots were taught how to dance, and they were dancing to the mashed potato, the song that Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey danced to, and in Dirty Dancing. So this is definitely something that keeps me excited reading all about this Artemis program. And I can just imagine the Boston Dynamic robots, for example, which I talked about a few weeks ago or a couple months ago, they could be designed to work in a factory, let's say lifting things at a speed and at a weight that humans just cannot do it. And they can work 16 hours a day. So they were talking about having 5 robots on site at a factory working 16 hours a day, not complaining, not asking for breaks, and they could do much faster and a lot more work than people could do. So when this does happen and we see how robots are integrated into this, and I speak about this robots because one of my students also, he has a robotics course at school, so they program a robot. They use C++ language, and in the Boston Dynamics section, which I did a couple months ago, that there was some speculation or an opinion that one of the reasons we haven't seen robots in our house is just they're just too costly. So when the costs come down, maybe we'll see more and more robots at our house or doing work in factory and at work sites, and it'll be exciting how they, what they do. And I could see that, for example, when the mission to Mars has finally given a go and the astronauts fly to Mars, I do believe the first mission they might just have the astronauts circle around Mars and not actually land on Mars. But imagine going 6 months and then not landing on Mars. But one of the things that the astronauts will need is a place to stay. So they're not going to fly to Mars and say, okay, let's start building accommodations. The robots will predate their arrival and will be there for a while probably, and will build all the accommodations and probably work with them. So it'll be this work with the astronauts on to do things. So this is an exciting, and it's just too bad the opportunity costs that were lost when the NASA stopped going to the moon, and 50 years later they're picking it up again. So this is the Artemis program. It tends to maybe, hopefully, if it's not canceled, bring us to the moon in a few years. So Artemis will try to launch again. Now I'm talking to you. It's past midnight, so it's in the early wee hours of the morning of September 22nd. So the next launch is scheduled for, the next launch attempt is September 27th, and I believe it said earlier October 1st, which is a Saturday. So they're pushing forward with Artemis. It was nice to hear these experts talking and nice to see that they keep working at it. So thank you for listening. Today I talked about the Artemis Moon program, and hopefully we'll get there sooner than we can say, what do they say, Jack Robinson or whatever. But anyway, thanks for listening. This has been Marco. You have listened to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.